Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Pony Development Sync call for January the 18th, 2022. I'm your host, Joe McElvain, and if those others on the call who are here with us would like to share their names so the people listening along can associate a voice to the name, now's a good time for that.
I'm Sean Allen.
I'm Rhett Davis.
Great. So, on our auto-generated agenda today, I think we usually we look at RFC pull request first. So let's get into it. In the ponylang/RFC's repo, we have a PR195 initial draft for built-in FFI safe only as default. It looks like there has so Red, you created this RFC kind of at Sean's request. It looks like Sean has some comments.
It wasn't my request. He said, what could I do to help? And I said, you could do this.
Yes. Okay. There's a subtle distinction there. You're right. is there anything we want to discuss about this RFC in the call here?
So my thing would be is I left a lot of comments. I think there's a lot of additional detail that needs to go into this before it'd be an RFC to fully discuss.
Okay. Do we want to discuss anything here on the call apart from that? Red, do the comments make sense? Do you want to talk about any of that here?
To be honest with you, I didn't see that there were any comments on the thing. I guess
okay.
I'm not getting GitHub notification, so I'll read through them and I'll address them straight after this call.
Sounds good. Okay, so we have also in the RFC's repo, we have pull request 194, add RFC to expose runtime scheduler information. This is from Sean. There's no comments here except for me quibbling about names. as I mentioned, I'm not going to vote against the RFC on naming alone, just trying to give suggestions that I think would make the library less annoying to people like me who get uptight about naming conventions. I realize that I am more uptight about this than other people are. So
I think we might have a bit of a disagreement on what is good naming and design. I don't think it's necessarily an uptight thing, right? Like, okay. So I approach this from, we were talking about, let's call this package runtime info because it could contain information about a lot of different things related to the runtime, right? And from that, then to me, it makes sense for in runtime info, if I want to get information about the scheduler, hey, here's a primitive called scheduler because we're in runtime info and this will give me scheduler runtime info, right? And that would be where this first bit of stuff goes, and then other things could go on other primitives if they're not about the scheduler. And I think for me, I think that helps from a documentation standpoint because now we can document this primitive as being about stuff for the scheduler. And if you're interested in just stuff for the scheduler, you can read just the documentation for that, et cetera. And I think you were suggesting a single primitive for all of the stuff. And then I guess it would have names like get max scheduler threads or cores or something, not necessarily with get in front of it, but something like that on it. And then additional things that they would be added would be like that. Yes.
I mean, that would be one option. It's worth noting that the existing primitive already is kind of like the method names would probably be the same as they are in the existing primitive you have here, because it's not like you have like scheduler.getNumber of them. It's like scheduler.schedulers and scheduler.activeschedulers right now. So I was sort of saying that it wouldn't necessarily need to be a change in the method names because the method names already say scheduler in them.
Yes. Well, oh no, I wasn't saying a name. I was just saying different.
I think separate primitives is fine. I have a little bit of an issue remaining in my latest comment with the word scheduler, because if I see a type named scheduler, and I guess the When you import types in Pony by default, right, they all get you know dumped into the common namespace for that file that you're working in. And mm-hmm. so if I type use runtime info, I now have you know, among the types that are accessible in that file, I have a type called scheduler. And to me, if it was runtime info.scheduler, like if I used the sort of explicit use thing that people rarely use, right, where they want to keep things separate, if I did use runtime info equals, you know, quote runtime info, then I would have runtime info.scheduler and say, okay, yes, that makes perfect sense in terms of like what the thing is doing. But if it's just a type called scheduler, that it makes me think that, okay. It could be something that I could give work to and it would schedule it. Whereas a name like scheduler info might be a little bit more descriptive on that front and also less likely to collide with, if somebody was say working on something similar to your fork join library you've been working on, and they have, I think you use the type there called coordinator, and maybe they called that same thing, same concept, sort of scheduler. And now they import runtime info and now there's a conflict and it's like, okay, well, I got to rename my thing, or I have to use the extra detail, or like by extra detail, I mean, like they use runtime info equals runtime info approach.
I can see where our difference is. Yes.
Yeah.
So you're saying you think that we should do naming, which assumes that people will not do the scoping. And I've always thought that that the naming should in general be assume that the package name is part of it, and that people would do scoping with the names where appropriate, so that they would do like use and then, okay, well, I'm importing runtime info and maybe I'll just call it, like, for my particular case, I might call it in this time, you know, it's inside info, and it'd be info.scheduler.activeschedulers, for example, or whatnot. And I think that that's where it is. It's a difference of which one of these do we default towards, right? Because
yeah,
if you do it like how I think we should do the default schedule it, we should do the naming on the basis of which way should we lean towards, then yours would be overly verbose, and if we do it based on yours, then mine is underly verbose. So yeah
and so just to be clear on like what my like overall preference is, like what you described is accurate for like what I would prefer in how, like, based on how the Pony language works today and how it is used. So like that's just sort of like assuming no other changes to the language or to, you know, common conventions in the language. I think it makes sense to prefer that. Go ahead.
I don't feel like that we do that in a lot of cases, though. We're not like
it drives me crazy. Yes, it's true.
In the vast majority of cases, we have names which assume, you know, that, hey, okay, this is the name, it's within this package. And if it happens to conflict with something that's in another package, well, then you can scope it, or you just scope it in general to start with anyway, right? Like in the fork join library, it's not called fork join coordinator and, you know, and fork join generator and blah, 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 et cetera, right?
Yes, this is...
Because you're
correctly describing that in many, many cases it is common to not do things the naming way that I would prefer, and like I said, it does drive me crazy to a certain extent. But like
your preferred naming thing drives me crazy.
Yeah. So to be a little bit more clear, like what I was mentioning just now is like you know, assuming is that like, yes, that's what I prefer, assuming like no changes to the language or how things are imported. My absolute preference would be to kind of avoid both sets of problems in involving other language changes and the way things are imported, to make it so that the types are named like you are specifying, and that So in my perfect world, we'd have the package called runtime info and we'd have the primitive scheduler in it like you want, but the way we import types would be different. And that's the disconnect is that in my perfect world, this would be defined exactly as you have it in the RFC right now. I think that's great. It's just that the way that Pony, the combination of that convention and the way that Pony use statements work, is what drives me crazy. It's not the convention that you prefer by itself. I think that is a good convention, but I think the way that Pony use statements works makes it troublesome and irksome to me. But with that said, like, again, I'm not, this is fine. I don't need to like rehash this, because I think, like you said, the naming here fits with Pony conventions. And even if I don't like necessarily agree with those, or what I really don't agree with is the use system and how it works. That's a kind of a separate topic and not really something that will hold up this RFC. So it won't, right?
Okay. So can we go back to 195 for a minute?
Yes.
So Red, when you say something like the packages section should mention that packages may request FFI access and a top level description of what that means, right? So I now know, you were referring to the tutorial. I didn't know what the packages section was. But then if this was going to be about the tutorial, I don't think that there is enough info in that statement that you made for anybody to really agree what's there. That's kind of a hand wave, right?
Okay.
And I would be looking for more detail, like, so that we could hand that off so that somebody who is not you or not me, right, for example, could look at the RFC when it comes time and look at a PR against the tutorial and say, does this cover what was agreed upon for the RFC, right? So where you and I, for example, if we were the only two people who wrote the RFC, right?
Mm-hmm.
You and I would feel comfortable with what's in the RFC with somebody who's not us merging the thing that that fulfills the RFC. So is there enough info for somebody who didn't write the RFC to be able to decide whether these changes fulfill the requirement? And I don't think for a statement like it should mention, I don't think that fulfills the requirement. That wouldn't fulfill the requirement for me. I wouldn't feel comfortable with taking that one sentence and then handing it off to, I don't know, any other person who can hit the commit button and having them decide whether the thing meets that requirement or not.
Okay.
for what we're thinking about for acceptance. And I think about everything in an RFC that way. And I sometimes in my RFCs do not do a good job of that at first. And hopefully when people are reviewing my RFCs, we'll also point out where I'm making assumptions about, you know, some things like that, et cetera, and everything. But so, in the end, I think RFCs do a couple things. They set precedents for why a decision was made, right? So that precedent could be used again in the future. They also capture specifically with as much detail as is reasonably possible what is supposed to happen, such that it can actually be merged based on that or whatnot. Or, for example, if something ended up coming in as a PR and it deviates from the detailed design, for example, whoever's looking at it can go back and go, this doesn't really match what was in the detailed design. I should not merge this, right? When I'm looking at somebody's implementation for an RFC, I always go back and I read the full RFC again and make sure that everything which is mentioned in the RFC that was agreed to is actually done. And that's how I make that for the most part is how I make the decision of whether it's acceptable or not. And so I think that the RFC needs to be detailed enough for that sort of decision to be made.
Okay. I think what I was unsure about was where the line for that particular section is between here's a punch list of the things that can be, you know, that should be covered, you know, the higher level, and here is the full text that should be inserted in this point of the document, which would be at the heavily detailed level. So it's working out where on that spectrum the expectation is. I think I've got where you're coming from there.
Yeah, I don't. It doesn't have to be the exact text, right? Or necessarily, unless it's a really simple thing, right? If it's really simple, like I put for the RFC for the runtime one, it is so small that I dropped in the class as I was imagining it, right? Because you know, well, there is. It's basically either that or nothing at that point. But yeah, there is finding a balance there. I think all of my comments basically on this on the FFI one are all coming from that place of, I don't think that we could turn this over to other people to merge it and decide whether it's actually what we all agreed upon without more detail.
Okay.
All right, so moving on to RFC's repo pull request 193. This is one entitled Make Array Iterator Classes Private to Hide Implementation from Client. In the last sync call, Sean mentioned that he'd like to see one of two things happen with this RFC so he would know how best to state his objections, like focusing on which area. One approach would be to update the RFC to state that it will apply to all collection iterators in the standard library instead of just array, or to update the reasoning provided in the RFC to explain why it would only apply to built-in and not set a precedent that should apply to other packages of the standard library. So either the reasoning applies to all the iterators in standard library, or specifically all collection iterators in standard library, or it doesn't apply, and we should explicitly state why it doesn't apply. The original poster said that personally they think option two is the best move. I'm a little bit confused now because it feels like this person is saying the opposite of what I had expected. So let me just read the text verbatim here for a second to think through it while I'm reading it. Now, if I had to select between direction one or two, I think that a design principle only on a part of a library would be a bad decision by creating an exception. The less exceptions, the better the language. The remaining paths are correct everything, two, or do nothing, cancel and close the RFC. So I'm confused because this person says two, when the two in my comment above was to update the reasoning in the RFC to explain why it only applies to built-in. And I believe this person is referring to one when they say two, so I'm confused.
I believe as well. I think it would be reasonable to get a clarification. So I think the statement for this would be is that if they believe that is probably the right approach, then and they want to argue for it, they can put in the time and do it. There's no guarantee that their argument will be accepted, right? So it's not like by us saying, yes, you should go ahead and do that if you want to, that we're saying we won't end up rejecting your change, right? Like there's, I read that as a little bit of, if people think it is worth my effort, right? As I only want to do this if it's going to be accepted is one possible reasoning. One possible reading of that statement, and I wouldn't want to mislead anybody into believing that simply because they put in the effort into an RFC that means it will be accepted.
Okay, I am typing up a comment now. While I type up that comment, do we have, so let's kind of multi-threaded things here and go to pull request 3953. This is a pull request from Jason that has been updated in the past 2 days. Jason, do you have anything? Do you want to say about this?
What repo?
Sorry, the Pony C repo pull request 3953.
Okay.
Ban variables whose capability is unsound to alias. We discussed this a little bit in the last sync call, but not much because it wasn't actually ready for review. And it seems like now it is.
Sort of, but it's failing tests and I'm really confused as to why.
Because your audio is really quiet, Jason. Is there anything you could do to update that?
Yes. How's this?
Yes, better.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, so currently it's failing tests. I'm confused as to the failing tests, honestly, because it's two tests where I have that it's supposed, they're supposed to fail to compile. When I run them, when I take the exact same code and I test it, run it through the compiler, it fails to compile. The tests error because they failed to compile and it sounds like they're supposed to compile, even though the test says they're supposed to fail to compile, and there's a lot of negatives there, but I don't understand why it's...
Is this, these are in stable type, right? In the libponies?
Yeah, those ones there, like, they expect failure, and the tests are... It's too many negatives to actually communicate. The tests expect an error, a compile time error. And they fail the test because they expect an error. They expect to not get any errors, but they do get an error. But the code says that they're expecting an error, and they do in fact get an error. So I don't understand why they're failing, basically. So
what? Huh? I'm very confused by everything you said.
So the message we're seeing is expected equality of these values, null, which is null, or program, which is zero by, you know, some pointer value, right? So the test is expecting the program to be null.
Can you tell me what the program message is to look for in the log?
I just looked on one of the failures. So this is
I found one. Yeah.
X86. Okay. So I'm looking at incompatible isect parameter. If you scroll up to where the failure text was, right, it's expecting the program, the variable called program to be null, and it is non-null. So it should be, it should be null if the program fails to compile, right? And so it's testing that the program is failing to compile by checking if the program is null. Does that match what you were thinking in your mental model, Jason?
Sort of. It's very opaque. That's what I thought it meant. But then it also says expected that it doesn't generate new fatal failures, and actual it does, which really the test harness is very confusing there, but
yeah, I think the test harness is negating the negation, like you were kind of mentioning there. This is, let's see, I'm just trying to look in the actual code to confirm. This is in util.cc line 362.
And so when you take this code and put it in a text file and compile it with the compiler built like this, what does it do?
It gives a compile error.
Okay.
In the verify stage, which is the stage that I'm running it to in the top.
Are you aware of the difference between in the compiler test, are you aware of the difference between like the stripped down basic version of built-in that is used versus the actual built-in?
Yes. So okay. This is all in the compiler stages. And I'm not aware of exactly how it runs the stages, but I was testing, like, the stage that I use up at the top is verify, which is the same one that the verify tests use. So I imagine that it means run up through the end of the verify stage, which is what I want. But it doesn't mean run up until the verify stage and, like, stop before it or something like that.
Yeah, I think that part's probably fine, but are you aware of the stripped down built-in
that the particular test uses that doesn't include everything? Fine. Yep, that part's fine.
Okay. So Yeah. So this error is coming from a utility function called test underscore error. And it's just trying to prove that the pass, that building the package to that given pass resulted in a program that is null. Yeah. And in these cases, it's running it and the program is non-null is what the output is telling us.
Okay, well, thanks. I'll keep looking into it.
So this is interesting. Like, so you have multiples in here that are test error, but only two of them are failing, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, is it
these ones possible? Are a bit different than the others, because these ones are in the verify stage. All of other ones are actually failing in a different stage.
I wonder if it is that, I mean, maybe because they fail in a different stage, it's not actually running through. I mean, I think it should be with verify, but I don't know. Huh?
Stable type.cc. So
I'm confused.
So hang on. This is the one called too many tabs. Incompatible isect parameter. And the other one is ephemeral iso parameter. So
the difference for both of these seems to be that it should reject even if never called. And those are definitely happening at the verify phase.
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, I could certainly try to find a way to put it earlier, but that's where I have it for the parameter checks, because that makes the most sense to me.
Yeah,
the other ones will happen in. If it was actually called, you'd get the error in the subtyping check when you call the function, because it can't actually make the subtyping check, because it would basically be nonsensical.
Interesting. So incompatible. I'm just trying to think if there's any way that the stripped down built-in could apply, because otherwise there should be no difference between the, you know, you running the compiler on a text file that has that content. The only difference that I'm aware of is
the other thing is release versus debug. I suppose I could try to make it real quick on.
I would be
also very surprised, but that is a difference.
Yeah.
I don't see anything here where the strip down built in.
Yeah, make I don't any see difference. It either.
I just like to the point of I can't even imagine that. I would be beyond stunned if that turned out to be the case.
Test error is running up to the verify pass. Yeah, I mean, we have so many other tests that are using the pass. Like, yeah, they use the pass name that it should run up to and including, and because it's the pass that you're testing, right? And so, but you're saying that some of these other ones where you expect an error, you're doing the check in the compiler in a prior pass, like in the like you said, the type checking, which happens before the verify pass. And so those ones are working in the interesting. I wonder if there's something wrong with the verify pass. Like not in the sense of being wrong in the final compiler, but if it's not hooking into the test harness correctly, like the other passes are. I know the verify pass is one that was added by me. I mean, it's been many years ago now, but like it was not one of the original passes. And so maybe something about the way I set up the verify pass is not matching how it hooks into the test harness for other passes.
Well,
I don't know what that would be, or I would have done it the first time, but yeah, that's something to consider, is that it might be something wrong with specifically the verify pass as it hooks into the test harness. And if you really, I don't know, if you wanted to see if it was like a problem of it not reaching the pass, I mean, well, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
Like you could put in like a later pass to troubleshoot, but yeah.
Okay, but we have other tests then that should like, okay, wait. Test compile. Okay, that's just test test error. So Joe, all of the only places where it looks like we do the verify pass, unless I'm missing stuff, all uses test underscore expected underscore errors. It doesn't use test error.
Yeah, so. I think it's because I think it does that because like I'm the one who added the test expected errors because I was tired of troubleshooting like things like, oh, this, you know, this test has a different error than the one it was expected to have, but it's the test case is still passing even though it has a different kind of error than the one that was expected. And so I added the test expected errors. And so, yeah, I think, yeah, it could be that something in the verify pass is not hooking in correctly to test error. And then that could either be fixed if we can figure out what it is, or you could try using test expected errors which is what I would want. I would prefer the test expected errors because it says it's a more robust test, right? It says what we're looking for. Although I guess it is fragile to the error message itself if we change the error message later, but that's not really a big deal, in my opinion.
But yeah, that is what's different about this, is that it's using test error. That's not used with verify anywhere else.
And yeah, because I created the verify pass, I added all the tests for verify, and I used the expected errors pattern for all of them.
Okay, I will try that. Thanks.
It might not be it, but it is what I was like, how could this not be working? Surely we're doing this. I'm like, okay, I see a thing that's different. So maybe that's it.
Yeah. And the expected errors is checking the actual list of errors rather than just checking that the program is null, right?
Yeah. So maybe the program isn't null when it's doing verify, because verify might be accumulating more errors accumulating errors differently.
Yeah, I wonder if verify is missing something that sets the program to null that the other passes might have. I'm just guessing.
That would make sense.
If I knew about it, then I would have done it in the first place in the verify pass when I added it. But because I don't know about it, I don't know what to look for. But yeah, something is usually setting the program to null for other passes. It's not setting it to null for verify, perhaps. And yeah, that could explain the issue without it being like an issue in your code or your test case, which doesn't seem to be. I'm just going to, I have one quick hunch I'm going to search for. So we have the refer pass, we have returning AST error. The verify pass, we have returning AST error. Okay, it's the same thing. All right. Okay, that one quick idea didn't pan out, so forget about that. Anything else you want to talk about with this PR besides the test failures?
Not much specifically, unless anyone else had thoughts.
I haven't looked at the implementation of it yet. Just kind of quickly scanning through the things that you're testing. They make sense as things to test and prove. So, did you run into any unexpected gotchas while you were working on this?
Not too much. I did find, it was kind of convenient that compatibility was sort of the right, well, trying to figure out how I got onto compatibility. I think because I wanted to find something that worked for both ephemerality and that made sense for the intersections, because I wanted to fold those in together because they were kind of the same. But I did find the randoms a very like niche bug that we had before, which is that you couldn't write, if you had a generic parameter, you used to not be able, or like you can't currently write T and T, interestingly enough. But No, I haven't actually run into any snags.
Okay. I can take a further look at this later, but yeah, thanks for working on this. Okay, so we have about 14 minutes left within the hour. We can continue with our auto-generated agenda, but first I wanted to ask if anyone has any other topics they want to raise for discussion first. All right, so with that said, we can continue the auto-generated agenda. There is a pull request listed here from me in the Pony C repo. I can quickly mention what's going on with this one. The title is Refactor Actor Pad Size as a Function Instead of Preprocessor Value. This is 3961. I added a do not merge label to this because I got CI passing, but in order to do so, I did something that I didn't really want to do, which was removing the inline keyword in C from those functions and moving them like the C99 inline semantics are kind of bugging me right now because I can't seem to have something be inlined and shared in a way that compiles on CI. It does compile locally, but on CI it's failing and I'm not 100% sure why. So I removed the forced inline and moved it from the header into the .c file. And now I was looking, I'm having trouble confirming that things are actually being inlined, and some indications show me that they might not be. So I put the do not merge label on there. So while we figure that out, Sean, I see you had 1 minute ago a question about how it works and asking me to explain a comment. I'll definitely add a comment explaining what's going on, but do you want me to also explain it here on the call or just add the comment?
You could, if you put it in a comment, that would be fine. And then I can go off of the comment for whether the comment makes me go, oh, okay, I get it or not. So it might be more helpful with just going from the comment.
Sounds good.
Because, yeah, I'm looking at it and I'm like, I understand and I definitely do not understand. So.
Yeah. Cool. So I will take another look at that later and see if I can figure out what's going on with inlining. The inline tooling in C is frustrating me. Moving on from there, we have some issue tickets in the Pony C repo, one for release 0.46.1. This is pull request 3963. I don't think we have anything to discuss with this release, right? That's just a marker. So let's look at pull request, issue ticket in Pony C repo 3849. Can't build 32-bit ARM code with Clang.
This is basically me. Riley had been working on this. I haven't heard from Riley in a while. He was at the point when he said he thought he was done, but he needed some work that got merged a couple months ago to be done so that he could update against it to make sure that the test ran, and haven't seen him around since then. So dropping a note, see if he replies or not.
Okay, sounds good. Moving on, we have, let's go to the Pony tutorial repo, issue ticket 486. Explain numeric widths, unsigned versus signed integers, overflow and underflow. This is a new ticket from Ryan Hagenson, talking about things to cover in the tutorial for those topics. It's marked good first issue and help wanted. Is there anything else you want to discuss about that here?
No, we took a previous issue, closed it, and decided that this was the approach, and cleaned up the history by just having this rather than a long series of conversation, which make it difficult to understand what was actually needed to be done.
Okay. It looks like, okay, yeah, there is a link back to the original ticket for those who want to read. That's good. We also have another ticket in that repo, in the Pony Tutorial repo, 485, update misleading as documentation. This is something we discussed in Zulip about what people might think as does when they see it versus what it actually does, and understanding that and making that clear in the tutorial clearer than it currently is. There was some discussion on how to cover that, some suggestions, and then it looks like Nicholas Hedman, before issuing a PR, wanted to get feedback on a first attempt, which is a link to that user's repo.
Yeah,
so go ahead
and give that a read.
So yeah, we should independently give it a read and give comments about what's going on there. So if anyone else wants to read along, that'd be good too, and see if it makes sense to them and not just to the seasoned veterans who already understand the concept. So yes. Looking at the Pony Patterns repo, we have a PR 57 entitled Re-Add Link to Purely Functional Persistent Data Structures Thesis.
Already merged.
Wonderful. We have, let's see, that's the PonyLang website. We have the Fork Join Library. There's an issue ticket entitled
This library isn't even released yet. I'm not finished documenting it yet. Not finished with the examples, so I don't think there's much point to going over this one right now.
Okay, sounds good. That makes sense. Is there anything else on the auto-generated agenda? It seems there is not. So I'll once again ask, is there anything else people want to talk about while we're here together before we adjourn? Okay, well, thanks everyone who attended and those listening along to the recording later. See you next week.